Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 356, Hanukkah, a bad Jew take. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And this is our Hanukkah episode. It's our, I don't know if we do this annually, but this is the episode where we're going to be talking about Hanukkah in its various dimensions. And one of the things about Hanukkah is Hanukkah presents. We actually have a Hanukkah gift guide where you can buy Hanukkah presents. Some of them are Judaism Unbound merch, but most of them are all kinds of cool things made by various Judaism Unbound guests. And that's part of why we want to have this Hanukkah episode a little bit over a week before Hanukkah, because we want you to have time to buy some of those cool items from past Judaism Unbound guests to give as Hanukkah presents if you want. So in order to do that, go to judaismunbound.com/Hanukkah. You can spell Hanukkah various ways and it should go there, but we spell it generally H-A-N-U-K-K-A-H. And one thing that you can also buy for Hanukkah presents is gift certificates for Judaism Unbound merch or for An Yeshiva classes. So if there's somebody that you've really been wanting to take an An Yeshiva class, you can sort of force them to by buying them an An Yeshiva gift certificate. In addition to that, when we talk about Hanukkah presents, there's another thing that you could do, which is maybe to give us a little present. Hanukkah time is a time where people like to think about their end-of-year philanthropic contributions. And if you would go to judaismunbound.com/donate and send a little bit of gelt our way, it would really help to keep this project going. So before we jump into our substantive conversation about Hanukkah, Lex, you're working on a project. I mean, we're working on a project, but you're driving a project that's super exciting that I wanted to give you a chance to talk about because I think you'll do a better job than me.
Yes, I am super excited to announce on this podcast that we're going to be doing an amazing Hanukkah program in partnership with the Torah Studio called Apocryphest. Woo! Yay! I'm imagining all our listeners exclaiming in joy. What is Apocryphest? Great question. It's a confusing name if you don't know what Apocrypha are and or what a fest is. Fest is probably easier. Big celebration party. Apocrypha is a name for roughly books that didn't make it into the Bible. For the scholars out there who know that Apocrypha is a contested term and some people like other terms, I know. We're just using a simple one that is recognizable, even if it's not necessarily perfect. But we are going to be exploring some favorite books of Jewish tradition that are not part of the Bible, but do have an important place. And we're doing that because the holiday of Hanukkah is connected to one of them prominently, the Book of Maccabees. But we're going to not just stop there. We're going to look at other books too. So stay tuned for some mini episodes about that and for an opt-in email list where you will be able to get all sorts of cool links and materials and ideas related to books that didn't make it into the Bible as part of your Hanukkah practice. So you can sign up for that email list on our website, judaismunbound.com, and you can hear the mini episodes starting just actually less than a week from now. We're going to release the first one before Hanukkah starts, and then there will be sort of every other day or so throughout Hanukkah, a new episode. So that's a little bit about Apocryphest. Sign up at judaismunbound.com/Apocrypha, A-P-O-C-R-Y-P-H-A.
Yeah, and some of the books in the Apocrypha or Apocrypha adjacent, as we discuss on some of those episodes, have to do with the holiday of Hanukkah and where those come from. So it's an especially appropriate time to be having an Apocryphest, perhaps the first Apocryphest ever in the world. I'm excited about this, as I often am about our projects. So here's a little bit of the framing that I was thinking that we could take on Hanukkah. We had a conversation a few weeks ago with Emily Tamkin, who wrote the book Bad Jews, A History. There's a history of something. I don't remember the exact tagline, but a history of bad Jews. And what's important to understand about that book for folks who didn't listen to the episode is that she is not endorsing the term bad Jews. She is giving us a history of how the term bad Jews has been used by various Jews to put down one another and try to win battles over what Judaism is going to look like, not through the greatness of their ideas, but through sort of the meanness of their insults. And I am thinking about one of the maybe earlier, not the earliest, but one of the earlier purveyors of the term bad Jews, or analogous Greek terms perhaps, was the Maccabees. They had a very strong sense of many Jews around them being bad Jews. I like to say, and I don't remember, we probably made this exact analogy earlier in the podcast history, but there's this way of thinking about the Hanukkah story that it really gets set off when some Jews are trying to open what is effectively a JCC in Jerusalem, where there's a gym, and they're going to have a Jewish space that's built around a gym and around the health of the body.
A literal gymnasium, by the
literally,
way, like the Greek term. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, literally, like everything you think about a JCC, why is it built around a gym? That was what they were doing, right? And so why were they doing that? Because they were part of this Hellenistic society, right? And that had Greek culture become a significant part of what was going on in their world, the way that Western culture is today. And they wanted to be part of that, not to assimilate. That's part of the issue that the Maccabees are saying, you're assimilating, you're giving up Judaism. And they're saying, no, we're not giving up Judaism. We're trying to bring these things into Judaism, into our Jewish experience. And in any event, the point is that I think it's an under-focused on element of Hanukkah that it wasn't only a war of the Jews against the, quote, Greeks. It was also elements within Jewish society of trying to figure out what was it going to mean to be Jewish. And we might imagine that the best way to see it is that the Maccabees won that battle, and the Maccabees were kind of religious extremists, and so that is what defined Judaism, except that the Maccabees' descendants very quickly began to take on some of those same Greek cultural affinities. And so I'm just sort of thinking about framing the whole story of Hanukkah as it's the holiday that commemorates the way that Jews call each other bad Jews. And what it means to observe Hanukkah in that mindset is not to celebrate the calling of other Jews bad Jews, but actually to have a holiday every year that reminds us not to call other Jews bad Jews and not to use that cudgel. And I'm wondering in my head right now, what would it look like to have a holiday that's really about having much more thoughtful debates about what Judaism might be and respecting that others have different points of view? That's kind of where I'm sitting, trying to make a connection between the book Bad Jews and this time of year. How about you, Lex?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I want to say is I actually want to quote you from that episode where you said something to the effect of like, look, I do think there are Jews that are doing bad stuff. And I actually want to say that they are doing things that are out of line with my values. And so like, to be really clear, we're not saying that everybody just has to get along and have no real passion about their opinions or commitments and like not conflict with other Jews. The issue is the ongoing trope of the idea of a good Judaism. And usually, by the way, that good Judaism is a very conservative, very what was done in the past, that's Judaism. And the badness is when you stray from it. Like that's what we're resenting and trying to speak out against. But definitely call things, ideas, rituals, holidays bad if they're bad. We do that ourselves. So I want to say that both because I want it to be clear and because we'd be hypocrites not to say that. The other thing that's coming to mind for me, I mean, my issue with the title of Emily Tamkin's book, Bad Jews, is not that you talked about how some people are like, oh, is she defending that term bad Jews? No, it's like in quotes, bad mm-hmm. Jews. She's mm-hmm. talking about the set of historical moments in American history where like forms of bad Jew assertion, bad Jew name calling have been used. My issue is that there's a way in which it's kind of an American centric title because her book is about the history of the United States and actually like the last 140-ish years of that history, there needs to be another book called Bad Jews that's about all the different historical eras. And I agree with you, Dan, that Hanukkah is absolutely featured in that book. Like Hanukkah is a moment in the broader story beyond just the last couple hundred years and beyond just our American context of, one group of Jews, you know, the Hasmoneans or the Maccabees, they are certainly saying that a bunch of other Jews are doing it wrong. And I think that how we do Hanukkah today really does relate directly to that question of who's a bad Jew, who's a good Jew, or at the very least, which Jews are we tracing our story to in history? Because there's two different ways you can understand Hanukkah. And one of them, I think, is common even among our own listeners that are very unbound in their thinking. But for a lot of people, sometimes me included, we have a really tough, complicated relationship to Hanukkah because we're like, I don't really like the Maccabees. And this is a holiday about a set of heroes called the Maccabees who win a rebellion, and we're celebrating that. Are we celebrating that? Or maybe should we be celebrating that? I actually think that this holiday becomes a lot less complicated, a lot less cognitively dissonant if we say, I'm actually not celebrating the Maccabees. I am tracing my story to a historical story, namely the conflict between Maccabees and other Jews, and between Maccabees and, you know, the Assyrian Greeks, the power of it. Like, I am interested in being part of that story because I care about who I am, a Jew versus, you know, society that is not mostly Jewish. Like, that's a story that is of deep relevance to me. So the part where Maccabees are engaged in warfare, are engaged in differences violently and otherwise with powerful forces, like, that's, I'm interested in being a part of that conversation and thinking through what that means. I'm also interested just as much in being part of the story of intra-Jewish conflict. I'm aware that I'm part of that. My job in my life, by being a host of this podcast, by all the work I do, is literally to be deeply in that debate. But I'm tracing my story not to the Maccabees. I'm tracing my story to this entire historical moment that matters to Jewish history. And then it becomes less complicated. I don't have to worry about the fact that, oh, I don't like the Maccabees so much. It doesn't matter if I like the Maccabees that much. What matters is that this story unlocks really important questions of what it means to be part of a broader culture that isn't just Jewish. What it means to disagree strongly with other Jews. Like, all of those things become part of the story. And for me, Hanukkah has become less complicated the last few years because I really have kind of fully hopped into the notion that it's not about the Maccabees.
Yes.
If I don't like the Maccabees, that doesn't mean I'm not doing Hanukkah.
Yes.
Most American Jews, and even Jews around the world, although Israel might be an exception, most of them, the Maccabees are not what this holiday is primarily about.
I love what you're saying, and you said it a lot better than I did. I think that one short way to talk about what you just said is that let's not frame Hanukkah as a holiday that celebrates the victory of the Maccabees. Let's frame Hanukkah as a holiday about the time of the Maccabees, and of course, about our time as well, right? But I guess I'm even wondering whether the word celebrating shouldn't be the word that we use. Not that we shouldn't celebrate Hanukkah. We're celebrating because it's Hanukkah and we love Hanukkah. But the holiday itself is not about a celebration per se. It's about remembering a certain time. Like, for example, again, I mean, you could say that Passover is about celebrating that we were freed from Egyptian slavery, but you could also look at it as that Passover is a time to remember that we were slaves in Egypt, or that our story says that we were. And whether we were freed or not freed, it could be just as powerful, because what we really want to reflect on is what it's like to be a slave.
And to meditate on the questions of, like, God created a bunch of plagues. Like, the difference between celebrating God freeing us versus, we're asking questions over this, over how this went down, engaging with a story once again.
Yeah, and I think to do so with Hanukkah is actually extremely traditional, because the rabbis had exactly the same, maybe for slightly different reasons, but exactly the same discomfort with the Maccabees. And they really changed the focus of Hanukkah from a celebration of this victory, which, by the way, they weren't so celebratory over, because they saw the Maccabees as quickly Hellenizing, which they didn't really much like. They saw the Maccabees as having ultimately, or the Hasmonean dynasty, making a deal with the Romans, which ended up getting the Romans into the land and causing ultimately the destruction of the Second Temple. So the rabbis were not very hot on the Maccabees for all kinds of reasons, and they ended up focusing the holiday on the miracle of the oil, etc. And then for I don't know, 1,000 years, Hanukkah was mostly about, more than 1,000 years, Hanukkah was mostly about the miracle of the oil, very little about the Maccabees. And then the Maccabees came back into the story in modern times for all kinds of reasons that we've discussed before in this podcast that have to do with goals of Israel to have a model of a fighting Jew and goals of the Americans to have, American Jewish community, to have a model of an anti-assimilation kind of Jews at a time where they were concerned that they were too much assimilation. So the Maccabees being central, or, you know, and the victory of the Maccabees being celebrated, being central to the story of Hanukkah, may have been the original meaning of Hanukkah, and it is certainly the contemporary meaning of Hanukkah, but it actually was not the meaning of Hanukkah for more than 1,000 years, and we could imagine that we could go back to a version of that one where, again, it's not celebrating the victory, it's marking the time. And for me, it's really a question of thinking about, you know, I wasn't really even going to be talking about this. I've obviously been thinking about this. We all have. But we now see that we have anti-Semitism out in the world that we have to fight against, all of us agree, and that we fear. And then we also have a debate within the Jewish community of what constitutes anti-Semitism. And for me, I don't want to necessarily get that into that debate right now. Maybe it's something that we should talk about on the podcast in the future. But what I'm just saying is that we have a variety of cases in our time today where we are having both arguments within the Jewish community about what the right way to be Jewish is, and we're also having elements of those same debates between the Jewish community and others. And that's a really hard thing to navigate. And I kind of think it's helpful to say, yeah, and we've been navigating that difficulty for thousands of years, and Hanukkah is our main holiday for thinking about that difficulty, and let's do it once a year. Then it becomes a really interesting reason to have this holiday.
Yeah, I really agree. And I think that we're talking about Hanukkah, but what you said about Passover really resonates for me. I really was thinking about it specifically about Hanukkah, but I think it works. We have this issue where, you know, and even when you read like ritual theory, when you read studies of what holidays are, there's different categories of them. And a lot of Jewish holidays fall under the general category of commemorations. Mm. Commemorating. They are taking a thing that happened in history, or often a thing that is said to have happened in history, whether it, like the Exodus from Egypt, whether or not that happened in history, it, for purposes of what Passover is, it doesn't really matter. It is commemorating that story. And so we actually have a choice between whether it's commemorating the heroes of that story or the story. And I have a lot of reverence for these stories. I don't use the word reverence that much. I think people think of our podcast as irreverent, and in many ways we are, right? But I do actually have a kind of reverence for some of the stories that ground our various holidays. What I don't have almost ever is a reverence for the hero characters. It feels almost idolatrous to me when the characters are not God. So even whatever you think of the Maccabees, they're not God. I also don't really have that much reverence to God. But like, even if I did, it would seem strange to me to really put these heroes up on a really high pedestal and not conceive of them as people like us. But even God, right? Like in the Exodus story, the character God that takes the Israelites out of Egypt, like I don't have a reverence to that. I don't know that that God is something I really would stand behind. What I do stand behind is the set of questions around what does it mean to be subject to oppression and rebel against that oppression? What does it mean tactically when one does so, whether you go to routes of nonviolence or violence? This is a story that chose violence. Now, the people didn't do violence, but God did. We kind of exported the act of violence from the Israelites to God, who does a bunch of plagues and literally kills a bunch of firstborn children. I'm interested, I'm invested, I'm embedded in the project of asking what we do in those moments, of having holidays where we engage with questions of power and questions of freedom. I'm not really invested in the project of God is super awesome. Yay. That's not something I'm really interested in. And I think with Hanukkah, what I'd add to this is that we've reinvented the story. It's not just this story of the Maccabees. There's now other later stories of Hanukkah. Hanukkah, the story is, you know, coming together as a family this is not a narrative story, but coming together as a family in a dark time of year to have light together. Hanukkah has morphed over and over again, and we should look at that as, Hanukkah itself is a story. I'm using the word story over and over again today, I guess. Like, it is an unfolding narrative, and we're a chapter in it. So what's the plot of our chapter? What are we bringing where Hanukkah progresses in one way or another from where it's been in the past? It would be incomplete of our historical era of Judaism for us to just take Hanukkah as is. So my hope is that we do new things with it. That's why we're trying this Apocrypha idea and bringing that layer to the holiday. But it leads to other things too.
Yeah. And by the way, some of why we're doing this episode and launching the Apocryphest a little bit before Hanukkah, before you would think to release Hanukkah stuff, is because we're hoping that people will have enough time to plan something for their Hanukkah that would be experimental, that would be new. Really, what I'm trying to do is encourage folks to just do some thinking on their own about what they would want to do, and then try to translate that in one way or another into some kind of practice. I'll tell you, though, that Lexi, earlier when I said I kind of want to radically think about what it would be like not to call anybody a bad Jew, and you reminded me, but I actually said in our conversation that there are certain people that I do want to continue to think of as bad Jews because they do awful things in the name of Judaism, in my opinion. Maybe what I really do want to do for Hanukkah is to have a week in my life where maybe I would practice not calling anybody a bad Jew. Not, you know, even the worst, you know, the ones that I think of as the worst. What would it be like for 8 days in the year to practice some kind of radical love and or radical attempt to understand? I understand that there are problems in trying to say I'm trying to understand people that I have a profound moral disagreement with, but there's something that appeals to me in having just in the privacy of my home. You know, I'm not suggesting that this be like a public day where we go out and all love each other, but some kind of experience where we practice some form of radical understanding, like that might be interesting. It might make me a better person the rest of the year, even though I go back in confirmed in my thinking that a certain segment of people are doing really bad things in the name of Judaism, but somehow I maybe am able to approach them a little bit more successfully in my conversations because I've practiced some form of radical love and understanding. And one thought that I have about how that might be enacted, this idea of Ushpizin that we're kind of taking away from the holiday of Sukkot, that there's this idea that every day you invite a different character from the past into your sukkah, and maybe you talk about them in some way or you think about them. I'm trying to think, like, maybe we could think about 8 characters from the Hanukkah story that represent different ways of being Jewish. And
the story, I'm going to argue, and I don't think you were disagreeing with this, the lowercase s story of Hanukkah over millennia, not just the Maccabee story.
Oh, maybe. I mean, I'm not opposed to that. I was just sort of thinking, though, I was thinking in the more narrow way of just saying, like, somehow we could orient our thinking in our conversation each day about a certain kind of biblical, or in this case, apocryphal figure. And that figure would stand for, like you're saying, the much larger, the much longer, you know, the way that the Hanukkah story unfolds generation after generation after generation. So maybe over time we can actually build up a sense, like here we're talking about Jason the high priest. I think that was one of the names. And
I want Judith to have a day. So even in the original story, I want Judith to have a day. Her being a character from one of the apocryphal books that's tied to Hanukkah.
Yeah, so but then maybe that person, we also say that person is the same day that we talk about, you know, Bernie Sanders or Emma Lazarus or whoever, you know, fits exactly that person. And it would be almost like what we see is this recurring cycle through history, right, where it's really not about the Hanukkah story per se. The Hanukkah story then goes into, even though it was historical, or we don't necessarily know all the history, but something really happened, but the story kind of moves into the genre of myth. We're not talking about reenacting or remembering history so much as we are using a historical event to create a new mythology, and that new mythology is where essentially we have 8 different kinds of opinions about what it means to be a Jew, and ultimately we want to somehow immerse ourselves in each of them so that maybe we can come out on the other side of the holiday both with a little bit more understanding of people who think differently than we do, and also maybe more strongly confirmed in whatever our deepest sense is, because we've actually opened ourselves to the others as opposed to almost denying that the others exist.
I, in general, think that we should have themes, or like there needs to be something differentiating day one of Hanukkah from day two, from day three. Like, otherwise, like what? Okay, so we have the Shehecheyanu traditionally. You have this special blessing you say the first night of Hanukkah. That's the only thing that really differentiates any one day of Hanukkah from the rest. So like, once you get to day two, it's like, I guess I've kind of done everything. I've had one night with Shehecheyanu and one night without. So now I'm just like repeating myself. It feels almost like, you know, the second day of Rosh Hashanah, where you do the same service for, in some communities that have two. And like, I'll be honest with you, I don't do a second day of Rosh Hashanah, because to me, it's like, why am I doing that? With Hanukkah, I do, just because I think I like the ritual. It's a smaller investment to put 5 minutes into lighting candles than it is to go to services for a few hours. I also think it's just, you know, aesthetically a nice thing, and you sing a couple sort of blessings and you hug your family and you exchange gifts. Nice. The other things you just said that came up for me, you slipped and you said, what if I took a week to focus on radical love? Hanukkah, of course, is 8 days. It's not a week. But that slip actually, I think, was productive, and it's pointing to something, which is something we always forget. The menorah that matters in the Hanukkah story, the original story, capital S, with the Maccabees, the one that they light when the temple is rededicated, Hanukkah means dedication or rededication, it has 7 branches. It doesn't look like our Hanukkah menorahs. Our Hanukkah menorahs have 9 branches with one, you know, captain branch that lights the others, and 8 branches. What we erase is that somebody a couple thousand years ago made a radical, fascinating ritual move. They said, we have an existing menorah that literally was in the temple, that was a central symbol of Judaism. There's evidence that the menorah, much more than the Star of David that we now take as a symbol, much more than many other Jewish symbols, the 7-branched menorah was like an emblem of this group of people. And they said, cool story, 7-branched menorah. We're going to have a 9-branched one that's actually going to become a lot more famous. That's a radical thing. It's not an obvious thing that people did. They made a drastic ritual move. What if we made this 7-branched menorah, which was never lit one candle at a time or one oil, like it was always all of it. The oil that lasted for 8 days, it was like the oil in all 7 branches. It wasn't that they lit one of the 7 branches, then the second. No, the oil of all 7. They created an entirely new idea of lighting one candle, then 2, then 3. Really, by the way, it's 2, then 3, then 4, because there's the captain candle, the shamash. That's all really interesting and radical. And so I really want our Hanukkah practice to be all about playing around with ritual and ritual design. I think that that'd be powerful. And the other thing you said that unlocked that for me is you mentioned Emma Lazarus. You didn't intend for this to lead to a big Lex rant. I think Emma Lazarus, and I hadn't thought of this ever before, you brought it to me. I think Emma Lazarus should be, specifically her, part of Hanukkah. I believe we should make Emma Lazarus across the Jewish people. If I could sign a document that makes this for everybody, I would do it. Because what is Emma Lazarus's most famous poem? It's the New Colossus. What is the New Colossus? It is a poem, a sonnet, that is at the base of the Statue of Liberty. That's all we say about it. People tend not to look at the actual text. The most quoted part of it is actually, I think, not the only interesting part. You know, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. It's this idea that the Statue of Liberty is symbolizing liberty and equality and the empowerment of people who are poor and immigrants. That's what's quoted very frequently. You know how it starts? Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame. This is a poem that starts with Emma Lazarus saying how a country is not going to be like the Greeks. Sound familiar? That's the Hanukkah story, at least some interpretations of the Hanukkah story. Now, what she's saying there, she's saying this symbol in the U.S., she's being very passionate, differentiating this place from classical Greco-Roman culture. We're not going to have a big statue whose purpose is to be intimidating. No, our statue is going to symbolize giving tired, poor, and huddled masses yearning to breathe free an opportunity. So that's how it starts. And then, you know how it ends? I lift my lamp beside the golden door. The Statue of Liberty is holding a candle, is holding a flame. And Hanukkah is a holiday of lighting flames. If you had to sketch out a perfect, picture-perfect, well-known popular symbol that we should, once again, I'm not here to say the Statue of Liberty is perfect. Like, the symbol is bullshit in many ways. America does not actually stand for all these things. It's an aspiration, not a reality. Mm-hmm. But having Emma Lazarus's New Colossus be a really central part of this holiday sounds really almost obvious to me once I look at the text of it. But we have to read the text of it.
Yeah, wow. Well, that was sort of, I think, like a random statement on my part. But wow, yeah. What you said about the menorah versus the Hanukkah menorah, it raises a lot of thoughts for me. I mean, just to illustrate the point, it's like we all think of the, quote, Jewish star, the Star of David, being this six-pointed star. Imagine that for some reason, somebody came along and said, well, the number eight is more significant, so we're going to have an eight-pointed star, and that's going to be the new Jewish symbol. Like, you can imagine the opposition. What are you talking about? An eight-pointed star is specifically not the Jewish symbol, right? And yet it happened, right? That somehow the eight-pointed star becomes the central Jewish symbol. And people say, oh, you remember once upon a time in ancient times, there was a six-pointed star and that was associated with David, but that wasn't really what we focus on now. So, but I was also thinking about our recent conversation with Jen Gubitz about weddings and just how much people are wedded to elements of the Jewish wedding that they think have to be this particular way, have to be the way it is. And it's exactly like what we're talking about here with the evolution of the menorah. The menorah didn't evolve into the Hanukkah menorah because somebody came up with an idea one day. It was because there are 8 days of Hanukkah, and so they needed a few extra branches if they were going to do it. I mean, it was an evolution that came about because of evolving needs and ideas about what this is for. When we think about a wedding, and we say, well, we're starting from a certain Jewish baseline of what a wedding looks like, but now things have changed. Now both partners might not be Jewish. The partners might be the same gender. We no longer want to supplement the ideas that that there's some kind of like financial transaction going on here with a religious overlay. We actually want to get rid of the whole idea that there's a financial transaction going on here at all, right? All these things change. And you can say, well, of course, as that changes, the nature of the wedding would change. And yet there seems to be a real strong pushback saying somehow, but if we were to do that, it wouldn't really be a Jewish wedding. And I'm trying to investigate. I'm trying to interrogate what's really behind that. Is it that in some way people are thinking, like in a kind of positive way, really what's happening at a wedding is some kind of spiritual bond that's being created. And if you don't say the spell exactly right, the bond won't really be created and the wedding will be ineffective. And that is why they're so concerned to make sure that we do this or that a certain way? Or is it just kind of run-of-the-mill general opposition to change and to experimentation? I want to give it a little bit more credit to say that specifically with a wedding, people are even more concerned than usual because they do on some deep level, and I appreciate this and want to affirm it, think that something really magical is happening at a wedding and we don't want to screw it up. What I'm wondering is what it would take to honor that aspiration and at the same time allow the wedding to evolve even more than it has been, almost making the argument that, no, what we're trying to do is to make the bond even more magical. So that's how I'm making the connection between Hanukkah and bad Jews and the wedding. It's just like, how do we move these conversations about a wedding out of the realm of good Jew, bad Jew, and into the realm of maybe good Jew, bad Jew, right? Like that somehow we're trying to really capture some magic that simply retaining the form of the traditional approach is actually in the way of making the magic happen. And I just wonder if maybe part of that is coming from people haven't experienced a wedding that is different from the norm, but super powerful, or maybe other things are in the way.
I'm really struck by the parallel you're bringing, because I'm somebody who regularly officiates weddings, and I'm also somebody who generally, at least once a year and sometimes more, when Hanukkah rolls around, I get a panicked message on Facebook or email or text from somebody who's like, oh my gosh, I forgot which side of the menorah I light first. What's the thing? And oh, and what's the right order of the blessings? I can't find it. Help me. I get those notes. And I do think it's like the same muscle being exercised, the same process underway, where with the weddings, people think as a starting point that the project is to adhere to a tradition. And the tradition is a certain set of words, a certain set of choreographies, a certain set of ideas. And they want to know what those ideas are. With Hanukkah, similar. Like, I tend to respond to people with like the right answers to those questions, but I usually tell them, like, what if you were gonna light fire in some way to commemorate whatever Hanukkah means to you? Like, how would you formulate it? Would you have one candle one night up to eight? Would you have eight down one? Would you have just one that you light each night? Would you have candles you light to remember certain people? Would you have candles you light to honor friends of yours that are alive? Would you have candles that stand for certain ideas or aspirations? Would you have candles in a circle formation? Would you have candles in a rectangle? Would you have candles in a triangle? Would you, like, I'm making up as many spur of the moment questions as I can, not because I actually think any one of those is like super deep, but just to get at, we should really feel that license. And what's funny is, like, menorah designers more and more do feel that license. There are all these fascinating menorahs with, you know, a few candles on one vertical level and then others on a different level. And in circles, they're in formations of different kind. And those are actually not trivial formations. They're the artists, like, getting at a different ritual understanding of what that moment is. And I love, or I hate, but I love observing these online conversations where people are like, oh, that menorah is not kosher. Mm-hmm. That menorah is not kosher because it's got to be that there's one captain candle, the shamash, and eight others, and the eight others have to be all on one level, and the one shamash has to be at a slightly different level. It can be lower, it can be higher, but it's got to, that's the correct formation. There's not a whole lot of evidence that that's actually, even by traditional rules, really a requirement. And
yeah, I don't know where that comes from.
It comes from this general sense that everything has to have a correct answer. The correct answer is pretty fire in dark time of year in a formation. Figure out what that is. I want us to, I do actually think we should definitely have fire personally. You could argue, and others could argue, like, we should try non-fire rituals, both for, you know, environmental sake, for like, I really connect to specifically lit fire candles in a formation. You one year specifically had, I think, like an oil lamp where you just lit, and it was one candle, right? It wasn't mm-hmm. multiple that would be ascend or descend. That is one example of this. And Hanukkah, I think it's counterintuitive because it has this really established rote way of doing it. You start with one, you go up to eight. But I think it's also, there's enough people who don't really feel that theologically or halachically or whatever, anything would collapse if you do it differently. Like, that, most American Jews, I don't think, really believe that God would be angry or something bad would happen if you change that ritual. So I think we have an opportunity to play around with it.
But here's the thing, like, that I'm thinking about with the connection with the Hanukkah and the wedding, which I think is so interesting, is that I think, like, well, you and I know this whole business about the menorah, arguably the Hanukkah menorah, the Hanukkiah, being potentially invalidated by the candles being at different heights. Now, I'm saying I don't know where that comes from, because in the Talmud, it's clear that it's not even required to have eight candles and all of that. So, like, it's somebody sometime decided that they all had to be at the same height, and somehow that got widely accepted. But I mean, it's not ancient tradition. But most people, I think, even if they hear about that, they're like, well, that's okay, whatever. I really like this menorah, and they're good with it. Whereas with a wedding, I think people really want to confirm with a rabbi that this is okay, that this is going to work. But I'm wondering why. Like, in a way maybe different from Hanukkah, people do imagine on some level, like not consciously even, that something really magic, spiritual is happening at the wedding, that somebody out there, God, right, is got a very particular way that God wants this to be. Even people that don't believe in God, you know, there's like somehow there's a, and I respect it. It's like, it's really like a magical spell and they want to make sure that they have it right. You know, so Jen Gubitz and I are co-teaching this class called How to Perform a Jewish Wedding. We had our first session and we were talking about the ketubah, which is the wedding contract essentially that gets signed traditionally before the wedding happens. And one of the members of the class who comes from, I believe, a Quaker background was talking about how in the Quaker tradition, there is a document, but what's interesting is that everybody at the wedding signs it.
Karaites do that also.
Karaites also. So that's so interesting. Yeah. So I was, when I heard that, I was like, wow, I've just learned something that would have made my wedding more meaningful. I mean, my wedding was very meaningful, but it would have been even more meaningful if everybody could have signed the ketubah or whatever document there would have been. Now, enters the traditionally trained rabbi or day school graduate and says, well, you can't do that because that will invalidate the ketubah because it only has to have two witnesses. It can't have, it shouldn't have more than two witnesses. And if any of the witnesses is not an appropriate witness, then it actually invalidates the whole document, or it might invalidate the whole document. And part of what I want to say,
I think they might be wrong even on their terms for that, by the way. But, yeah.
But what I want to say about that is, like, I don't care. And I think it would make it more meaningful to what I understand to be happening in the wedding, or what I want to be happening in the wedding, which is that the guests, so to speak, at the wedding are not just guests. They are participants. They are creating a community that is welcoming this new couple as a couple into the community. And I would really prefer to have their signatures on a document rather than just pictures of the wedding party. I guess what I'm trying to figure out here and to sort of tease apart is, what would it look like to take absolutely seriously the idea that at a wedding, but ultimately I'm saying about every Jewish holiday, every Jewish practice, I want to take seriously the idea that this is actually magical. And if we take that as a starting point, then I would say, number one, most people, most of the time, experience most of Judaism not that way. So therefore, if you accept my premise that the whole idea of a lot of this, not all, but a lot of this, is that you should be having feelings that magical, amazing things are happening, then number one, it's currently not working. Number two says, okay, what if I could find a way to reimagine this ritual in such a way that everybody who participated in it would walk away feeling that it was magical? Would it be a problem if that way in which everybody felt that it was magical actually violated Jewish laws and old ways and whatever, such that you would rather have it be correct, in quotes, you would choose that over the magic? And I wonder whether there's a certain way to describe at least what I'm after and what I've been after for 7 years here, you know, on this podcast, is saying that, no, I'm really sort of positioning myself with a camp who might say, we want it to feel Jewish and we want it to feel magical, and it doesn't matter whether it is in conflict with things that have defined what makes it Jewish in the past. So I'm not saying that I want it to be less Jewish. I'm just saying that I want it to be differently Jewish. It's an affirmative aspiration to maintain something magical and Jewish.
I don't want to be arrogant in this conversation, but that's basically what I strive for. And I think I'm not going to say every wedding achieves this, but I think often there is a sense of both what I'm going to call, because it's what some of the couples are thinking about, but like Jewish authenticity. Like, it feels like it was true to Jewishness and Jewish tradition. And it feels true to these two people, independent of anything else, independent of anybody's tradition, Jewish, whatever other religious traditions are part of the equation. It's true to them. and that's where the magic comes in. I think the magic is, and this is what Jen Gubit said in her episode. It's like when two people are saying words and doing actions that are real to them. If people walk seven circles because they're supposed to walk seven circles, I don't think that's the magic. I think the magic is when people walk seven circles because they have a deep connection to what that moment is doing, either because there's an idea of circles, whether that's, you know, circle of life, whether that's circles being a kind of way that you ritually tie yourselves around each other, like you're wrapping tefillin in a circle seven times around your arm, whatever it is, like that's where it's magic. So the magic is, it's actually not about the practice, the ritual. It's about whether the ritual is tied deeply, whether it's connected deeply to intent, to the essence of those people and what they're striving to be. Like that's, and I do say almost every wedding I do, I mean, if people specifically don't want this said, I don't, but like most of the time I say to the kahal, to the community that's there, I avoid the word audience. You're on stage. Now, you're not at the front of the room, but we think of weddings and we think of religious ceremonies as like two-dimensional, where there's a front and a back. The front being the chuppah in a wedding, like where everybody is under the wedding canopy, like the two spouses and the officiant, the people that are, you know, quote, standing up in the wedding, and then the quote-unquote audience. That's not what's happening. If we thought about it as three-dimensional, we're actually... the ground is the stage, the ground that both the audience, quote unquote, the ground that both the community and the chuppah are on, that's a shared stage that everybody is on together. The people watching aren't watching. They're in it. You are in it. You are a witness. You might not be signing the ketubah. That is an official way of witnessing. For a variety of reasons, I actually do endorse, for those who feel called to it, to have specific people that is not everybody sign your wedding as a way, almost in the way that Christians have godparents for their children. Like you're designating certain people in your life as having a real kind of role. So I do think there's a place for that. I also think that what you described with having everybody aboard is powerful too. But like that all comes from a willingness to start from what works and then sort of retrofit the Jewish, as opposed to start with the Jewish and retrofit what works. Some rabbis, like, yeah, they're willing to compromise on some of the Jewish. They will change some of the words. They will change some of the actions. Absolutely. I'm not saying conservative, even Orthodox rabbis. There is actually some flexibility. But when you're starting from the Jewish and saying, here's the starting point, which of these options feels best for you? As opposed to, what feels best for you? Oh, you want to express a connection to heritage and lineage of your family. How do we do that? Jewishly or generally, you want to express that everybody in the room is part of your union, is part of, it's not just that they're watching. It could be that they sign the ketubah as a whole to do that. It could be that the clergy says directly, you're in this. And every one of these seven blessings we say, I'm going to pause and I'm going to wait for you to say amen, because you are actually out loud affirming with your amen that you support this. And it's not trivial, like that you will support this. Like I say versions of that. I don't say it this aggressively, but like—
I was thinking as you were talking, like I was wondering, like, do you say this? Do you say it aggressively? And also, do you say it before the bride and groom even come in? Like that would be interesting to like say to the congregation or the yes. kahal, you know, you to tell them what their role is before the ceremony even starts.
So I often do at the so I tend to say this at different points. It depends on the flow, the ritual flow. Like everything I do is in different orders. But often it's when I'm telling people to turn off their cell phones. It's terrible that the first thing at a wedding out of most officiants' mouths is, please, if everybody could turn off their cell phones, that'd be great. Like that's, you can't say it that way. Like you have to find a way for that to be sacred or ritualized. Like it has to feel, because you're setting a tone. Whatever comes out of your mouth first, no matter what it is, sets a tone. So I tend to be like, hey, everyone, we're going to ask that everybody turns off their phones. And the reason for that is that when you hold up your phone to take a picture, it's sending a message that you are outside of what's happening. And what's happening is in front of you. We have amazing photographers here today that are absolutely going to preserve the memory of this. You're actually part of what's happening. So my hope is that you can eliminate the barrier of your phone between you and the car. I say a shorter version of this.
I love this.
But like my hope is that you can eliminate that barrier. Let's take a moment and really soak into this and be ready to be part of what's happening. Once I've said a longer version because this is a podcast and part of at a wedding, you have to keep everything concise. I'm not the star. I'm the officiant. But that's kind of the direction I'm going.
That's awesome. I want to talk about this more in the future for sure. I want to put a little bit of a Hanukkah bow on this because there's a little story years ago, and it's on our website, right? I invented this new kind of menorah that was a test tube rack with 8 test tubes, and it had certain chemicals in it, and they're the chemicals that are in glow sticks, and you would pour hydrogen peroxide, which is a clear liquid, into each one of them, and it would start to glow. And to me, that felt magical. That felt like what the whole story of the candles that never went out was all about. It was about feeling magic. And I loved that whole thing, and I wanted to figure out how to like market it as a new menorah. And what happened was I went to a friend, a person that I know that is really much better than I am at creating products. And I said, would you be able to figure out how to make this a product that could be sold and that could be shared with people? Because I think people would love this menorah. And the person said to me, no, because it wouldn't be kosher. And I said, it has to be kosher in order for you to even like distribute it? I mean, like, I don't care if people are experiencing it as kosher or not kosher. They can have another menorah too. I just think this would be a really cool supplement. And they said, no, it would be confusing to people. It wouldn't be kosher. And I felt like, wow, so that was an example where we're really just going to kill the possibility that people can actually feel magic by insisting on this notion that, but it has to be a certain way. And so for me, that's where, like, I don't know, I want to leave it in terms of trying to tie some of this stuff together about Hanukkah, about weddings, about ritual reimaginations. And I hope, and I know we'll continue the conversation.
Yeah, 100%. And I hope that this landed well on people. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts, your questions, your feedback on this conversation, on, you know, the bad Jews part, why it is that we establish all these correct ways to be Jewish and these quote unquote incorrect ways to be Jewish, and the ways that that ties to Hanukkah. But we're going to close out. And as we do so, one more reminder that we have our Apocryphest, our 8-day connection to these books that did not make it into the Bible as a way of observing Hanukkah. You can sign up at judaismunbound.com/apocrypha. If you forget that, just go to judaismunbound.com and click on the Apocrypha header at the homepage, and you'll be able to sign up for our email list that's going to have all sorts of jam-packed content for how Hanukkah can be a way of connecting to these different books of the Apocrypha. And in addition, we hope that you'll be in touch with us. And there's a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, there's our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram handles. All of those are at Judaism Unbound. You can always send us notes at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. And of course, at this time of year, we really do appreciate any amount of financial support that you're able to send our way, which you can do on a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift via judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.